Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, welcome along to Writer's Routine. This week we're chatting to Amanda Jennings all about her new novel, The Storm. It's an exploration of power set in a Cornish fishing port in the 1990s. We talk about why she likes writing in the frenzy of being against a deadline, always has, probably always will. You can also hear how she's got on writing in lockdown, has being isolated hampered her ideas. And also, you can hear how she beds in the themes deep into the story. And really, with that, there aren't any rules.
It's not an exact science, I have to say. It's just something I enjoy doing. And I enjoy having, I enjoy a book that has a sort of overarching theme in terms of emotions and the areas of the sort of human condition, I suppose, for want of a better word, that I'm exploring.
Loads more with Amanda Jennings on the way. Stay there. It's a brand new Writer's Routine. Yes. Welcome along to Writer's Routine. My name's Dan Simpson. Hello. This is the show where we take a look inside the working day of some of the most successful authors around. I've just realised, if you're listening to us for the first time, the working day maybe doesn't sound like the most exciting thing ever, but I know that if you found us, it's because you are interested in the craft of telling stories. So I promise, if this is the first episode you're listening to, stay there. You will find some advice, some inspiration in this show that will help the way that you tell stories, because we've got an incredible chat. It's with Amanda Jennings. She writes haunting thrillers. They all seem to explore a theme of loneliness and isolation. We talk about why she's drawn to that, why she keeps coming back to that, and how she unpacks that. Now, her new novel is called The Storm, which is set in Cornwall. And if you want loneliness, I mean, Cornwall is a place to find it. I mean, maybe not at the moment, actually. It's the height of summer. It's heaving down there. I mean, I know it's heaving down there. It took me 7 hours to drive like 300 miles back home from there the other day. Anyway, if you're not from the UK, Cornwall is like the little bit at the very southwest of the country. It's a stunning county with beautiful coasts, amazing beaches, but also barren wilderness in places too. The story is all about Hannah, who seems to have married the perfect man, but she's controlled by that man, controlled by her husband Nathan when no one sees. And it all centres around a storm that happened years before. You can hear more about it in the chat. We also talk about the frenzy of her writing and how she charts the plot or her lack of a plot and how she feels out her ideas. We talk about what she's learned from years of writing and storytelling and how she's changed her writing routine along the way. And we start, as always, with what Amanda Jennings sees around her in the place where she sits down to write.
Okay, well, I'm actually at my desk right now, and actually it's much more interesting than it would normally be, because yesterday I decided I was having trouble focusing, which I'm sure we'll come on to later on, but I decided to print off my cast of characters. So I searched the internet all day, and I now have a wall in front of me that is covered with faces with their names and ages, and also pictures of Cornwall Bodmin Moor. I've got some standing stones and a lovely granite farmhouse all pinned to the wall on scraps of paper. Piles of books, quite messy, empty teacups and coffee cups, toast plate, and that's it. Piano behind me, where my kids will sometimes practice piano if they're being good.
Are you in a study? Are you in a spare bedroom? How does that work?
So We have a sort of we're lucky enough to have a sort of space for a sort of larger study that doubles up as a, you know, a practice room or somewhere where the kids can escape each other and things like that. So it's just sort of an extra room. So I am fortunate in that I have a bit of space, which is great.
Aside from this assortment of faces that you managed to find online yesterday, what else is there on the wall? Would I find pictures, maybe sources of inspiration there?
Behind me I've got a beautiful, there's an artist called Jenny Saville who paints quite brutal pictures. And I've got one of her, a print of one of her self-portraits behind me, which is sort of all in reds and oranges. And not everybody's cup of tea, but I love it. I've got a couple of little statues of people reading to hopefully inspire me. And that's it, really. I think that's it. We've got lots of books, lots and lots of bookshelves, walls of books, which is also lovely, and a shelving unit above me, which my husband put up a few months ago, which was supposed to organise me, but is obviously just carrying more mess.
And talk me through your desk then. I'm always fascinated by a writer's desk. It's one of my strange things. Is it a big oaky deal? Is it an IKEA one? What are we talking?
Oh, nice. Okay, I've never described my desk before. So I could lie and tell you it's immaculately tidy, but I'm not going to do that. So it is a sort of, I would say, reproduction antique, if that makes sense. So it's a sort of almost like an old school teacher's desk that you might have at the front. So it's got a few little drawers, some nice brass handles. I don't think it's very valuable, but it's sort of, you know, it's not a modern one. It sort of has an air of tradition about it, I suppose. Yeah, I've never really said it's a nice sort of burnished sort of, what do you call it, like a warm oak colour.
Is it strewn with notebooks and post-it notes?
Oh, Dan, it is strewn. Is it strewn? I am very chaotic. So it is, it goes through, I have one of those weird people who's quite untidy but finds it quite difficult to concentrate in mess. So every now and then I'll do a huge tidy up and it'll be beautiful and I'll have some flowers on it and put the light on and things. And then gradually it descends into chaos. So right at the moment we're sort of on the ascendant chaos. I think I tidied it about a week and a half ago. So yeah, we've got a lot of notebooks. I write, again, I'm sure we'll talk about notebooks. They're very important to me.
Well, so let's talk about that now, Amanda. So how you say they're important to you, how do notebooks kind of work their way into your writing day?
Well, so they are fundamental. So I would call myself a planner. Sorry, not a planner, a pantser, as Stephen King would call it, writing by the seat of my pants. So I don't do any detailed planning before I write. So I will have a vague idea. And again, we can talk about any of this in more detail if you'd like to at any stage. But so I will have a vague idea and a sort of shadowy cast of characters. And then I sort of launch into writing the first draft, and I don't stop until I reach the end. But what I do have before that, and it can be up to sort of, it can be months actually, it can be sort of 3, 4, 5 months worth of notebooks where I've got all sorts of things, sort of scenes or snatches of dialogue that have come to me. If I know what themes I want to be writing in my book, which I generally do, I start to sort of just sort of think around themes like that and work out how each of these characters could, for example, demonstrate some guilt or some, because I like to have echoes throughout. So some of the characters will be struggling with one of the themes in a major way, but I also like to just draw a little bit of a spotlight onto sort of, say we took guilt. So someone might have done something for which they carry a huge amount of guilt, but then I also like to see little characters struggling with guilt in minor ways throughout that. So that would work as well. So notebooks are a great place for that. And they're very scruffy. I have them, lots of sort of, you know, asterisks and arrows. And I, again, a little bit like starting off with a tidy desk, my notebook always starts with a very tidy front page where it says, you know, the title of my book in my very best handwriting. And then a few pages in, it starts to just disintegrate again to chaos.
Aside from, and I think I know the answer to this already just because how much of a pantser that you say you are, aside from the faces that you've now got all over your wall, if I were to walk into your writing space, into this room, when you're in the middle of working, would I have any clue as to the story that you are telling? Are we talking post-it notes everywhere? Have you got little ideas jotted on the walls? How does that Right.
No, none at all. So you wouldn't have a clue. My youngest daughter, she's 14. My youngest daughter came in today and to ask me something about school. So obviously I told you that I'd only put the pictures up yesterday. So she came in and sort of gave me a kiss and then noticed the pictures and went, wow, this looks like an interesting book, because this book is full of, there's part of it that's set on, this is the new book, not the one that's coming out. This is the new book I'm writing at the moment. And it's partly set on a sort of an off-grid commune in the early 2000s. So all my pictures are of cool sort of dreadlocked hippies and farmer types and people that look quite interesting and unusual. So you would probably... And then there's obviously, as I said, the pictures of Bodmin Moor as well. So you probably get a good idea of setting and a taste of the characters, but you wouldn't have a clue about the book. No, I have no post-its, no index cards, nothing there at all. It's all, unfortunately, in my head and scattered around in a very disorganized way in various notebooks. You definitely hit your nail on the head there by specifying that it was a writing day. So I think I'm someone who needs a deadline. I like to work with a little bit of pressure. So I know that I have friends who will write, and I'll write a certain amount of words every single day throughout the year. I'm not someone who does that. I need to sort of feel the pressure and the bite to get a draft out. So as I said before, with the notebook stage, it's a sort of a bit more airy-fairy. But if we have a writing day, there is a lot of procrastination, so I don't know whether you want me to sort of I might add that in for some flour. Right, so we get up and I get the children to school, and then I will immediately walk the dog, and I generally, when I'm right in the center of a book, that time will be a good time for me to have a think about what I'm going to write and about the scene that might be coming next. And if I'm not in that desperate throes of writing, then that will be a time where I'll probably pull up Twitter or Facebook and just sort of potter and distract. I'm very easily distracted. So on a writing day, yeah, we've planned the scene, and then I get back and it'll take me a little bit of time just to sort of tidy away breakfast and, I don't know, clean down the kitchen and just sort of get myself together, feed the chickens. We have a couple of ponies here as well, so I go out and I'll feed them and I'll check them all over, and so it's quite sort of bucolic morning, I suppose. Lots of animals and lots of fresh air. And then I will sit at my desk and I will punctuate incredibly frenzied writing with cups of tea. And the cups of tea will invariably go cold as I've left them to overbrew or got distracted by writing. So then I will put it in the microwave and take another break. And I will invariably find that same cup of tea then cold in the microwave. And I will sit at my desk and be frenzied writing and or distracted by social media until about 3 o'clock. And then I'll probably go and take the dog out for another walk and then prepare for the children to come back home. And then I will probably hang out with the children and do all their bits and pieces and enjoy them and do a bit more with the animals. And then at about probably 7 o'clock, when my husband comes home, and this is a traditional thing. I used to do this when the children were small. My children are older now, so it's lost its relevance. But as soon as he would walk in from work, I would leave him to spend some time with the children, and I would do another hour and a half of writing. And then if I'm in the middle of a first draft, I will print off whatever I've written today. And it does need to be a whole chapter for me to do this. I can't give my husband partial chapters, but I'll try and get a whole chapter written in that day. And I will thrust it under my poor husband and long-suffering husband's nose and jump around until he promises to read the pages and then tell me exactly the bits that he likes and doesn't like. And I'll watch his face for every reaction. So I need, if I've written something sad, I need to see that in his eyes. And if I've written something that I think might be a little bit witty, I want to see him smile. So it's quite exhausting being my husband, poor man.
How big a part does that play? I know you've said you've done it for quite a while now, ever since the kids were young. How much are you judging from your husband's reaction? If he said, well, this could be a little bit better, is it a case of always listening to him, or is it very much, for quite a lot of it, you know best?
Absolutely. I mean, he is incredibly integral to the process. I have to admit, I started writing the first unpublished book when my second child was a baby. So that's 18 years ago. So and Chris and I met at university. So I do really value his opinion, and he's not the type of person to take that sort of responsibility lightly. So he's not going to tell me that it's good if he doesn't think it's good. What he does do, which is always disconcerting, is I'll write, and this possibly isn't the first draft because I know my first drafts aren't very good, but sort of a couple of edits in, a couple of rewrites in, I'll hand him the pages. And he'll say, yeah, you know, looking forward to you putting the magic in, or however he phrases it that day. And I will be affronted because I'll think that it's done, and the lazy side of me wants it to be done, and I will know that it's not quite there yet. So he doesn't come out with overt criticism, but he will tell me. So, for example, first draft stage, he read a chapter a couple of days ago. And he was like, yeah, it was a bit that dragged in the middle. And what's interesting about it is I know it dragged in the middle. I was hoping I might sneak it past him and he wouldn't notice, in which case I could ignore it. But I knew that it dragged in the middle. So I find his input very, very useful. It's a benefit of our relationship that we sort of do trust each other when it comes to things, you know, to things that are like that are important.
A rather wide possible philosophical question here, but why do you let yourself get away with it until someone else brings it up? Like, you would just think that, I mean, you're four books in now, and if you know this about yourself, if you know that, hang on, this chapter is dragging in the middle, maybe it's not good enough. Why do you think, and this is not a criticism to you at all, I'm just, you know, big picture stuff, why are you letting yourself get away with it?
Well, that's a very astute point. I think, to be honest, I probably wouldn't let myself get away with it. I might sort of not necessarily address it quite so quickly, but I rewrite many, many times. So I'm going to pick that up at some stage. And if I don't pick it up, my agent will. And if my agent doesn't pick it up, my editor will. And if my editor doesn't pick it up, then we're not going to worry about it.
So people on Amazon will.
Well, you know, I think, you know, you're not going to, I'm just about to bring out book five. And I have to say, after, you know, my first one came out in 2012 and terribly, terribly affected by readers. And I have to say now, I've got a little bit more experience under my belt. I do know that you can't please all the people all the time. So I have to, you can't think of every single reader. You have to think of your ideal reader. For me, in this case, I write what I would like to read, but my ideal reader is my husband. Again, I have good pedigree with that. I think Stephen King's first reader, his ideal reader is his wife. And I think that happens with lots of writers as well. But if it doesn't make it, if it makes it past myself, my husband, my agent, and my editor, I think, you know, we're sort of hopefully quite sure that we're doing something right, at least. Possibly not for everybody, but hopefully for most. So I'm currently writing book six. So I've four books are published. One's coming out in 3 weeks, and then I'm now writing book six. So, and actually, I had two unpublished books before my first one was published. So I feel a little bit more like I slightly know what I'm doing. So yes, exactly. I think when I'm really in a first draft, so I will write my first draft very quickly, or not very quickly, sort of relatively quickly, and then I will edit for months. So my first drafts probably take anywhere between 6 weeks and 12 weeks, and then I'll edit for some of the books I've edited, you know, as much as 18 months and rewritten for 18 months. But if I was really going for it, I can write up to sort of, I don't know, between 2,500 to 4,000 words a day, which is quite decent. I think I wouldn't want to put, if I was in the middle of a first draft and I was trying to get that done in one hit, then I wouldn't want to be going underneath 1,500 words a day.
How do you know when you're done of a day? You know, you say you get to 3 o'clock and then you need to go and pick the kids up or whatever. But is there a point in your writing where you're willing to kind of let that rest for the time being?
Oh yeah, I'm not very obsessive actually. So basically, I work in chapters. So I try and as I said, there is a variation in this. I'm not a very planned person, but if my my books are sort of between 40 and 50 chapters long, for example, between 90 and 100,000 words. We're sort of looking at, if I wanted to do my first draft in 6 weeks, ideally I'd be liking to get a chapter out every day for that period of frenzied writing. Now, I am putting a caveat in that because I haven't been able to write like I normally write with everything that's going on around us and outside of us. I found it quite distracting, and I'm actually trying to do a lot in my community. So I'm sort of not quite so in the study as I was. So actually I write in chapters, and that's a really good question. So I won't try and finish a chapter by 3 o'clock, but if I'm nearly there, that'll be the moment that I was talking to you about earlier, where my husband will walk home, and then I will finish that chapter and try and give it to him after he's put the children to bed, and when he can give me some time. So actually, if you think about it, he's coming home at 7 o'clock, and I have then actually got 2 hours that I could write and finish my chapter. And that's plenty of time for me to even if I had to do 1,500, 2,000 words, I would have time in that 2 hours. So I can sort of use that time to finish up whatever I want him to read that day.
How long has it taken you to realise how you work best? You say that you quite like being up against a deadline. You like this furious, frenzied writing, how you describe it. How long were you into a writing career when you realised that this is how you do work best? And what was it that kind of set you along that method of thinking?
Well, actually, I mean, we're talking way before. I've always worked up to the end point. So I'm not someone who has a nice piece of work sitting on their desk to hand in to a teacher, 3 days before you were supposed to give your homework in on a Tuesday, for example. I will be doing that, all the way up, and probably on the bus to school would have been doing my homework. I remember very clearly, I wrote a 10,000 word dissertation for my degree, and I remember very clearly standing in the queue of the binding, the stationers where we had our degrees, our dissertations bound, and chatting to a young man in the queue. And that was at a quarter to midnight, where the dissertations had to be handed in on midnight that night. So it's just the way I've always worked. I just need, again, someone, when I was taking exams, A-levels, GCSEs, any of those exams, I was someone who, when they said, put your pens down, I would still be writing or doing my final full stop. It's just, I always thought people who finished a couple of minutes before the end of a question in an exam and had time to read through, I thought, well, I found that quite unusual. So it's just been the way I've worked. And then I started writing when the children were small, as I said to you, my second child was a baby. So I would write in any little moments that I had spare. So if she napped, I would ignore the housework, I'd ignore everything, and I would take out my writing. If we were traveling in the car and she was in the car sleep, the car seat and fell asleep, I would pull over in a lay-by and bring out my edit notes or my hard copy or my, a notebook, and I would write until she woke up, because I figured it was easier to drive with a baby who was unsettled or crying than it was to write. So I think I've always found that those limited amounts of time focus my mind. And the flip side of that is I'm very capable of stopping mid-sentence. So likewise, if a baby woke up and needed me, I would be able to stop mid-sentence almost, then go back into my role as mother, or whichever role I was there for fulfilling at that moment, and then come back at whatever time and take up from that half written sentence. So it was an opportunistic way that it developed, really, because I didn't have any other option. I didn't have a nice peaceful house. I had 3 children and lots of animals, and a husband who was working from 7 o'clock until 8 o'clock every day. And so it was just something that I had to do. I had to find those moments myself.
But now you don't need to find those moments. And I'm whatever works for you. That's perfectly fine. But now you don't need to find those moments. Now the opportunities for you to write, I would imagine, are quite extensive, having published so many books. Why are you now still forcing yourselves into these situations where you do have to write frenzied? And what would happen, do you think, if you if you didn't do that. If you just sat down every day and said, right, I'm going to get 1,000 words down a day, and you know, it'll take me as long as it does, what would happen then?
Well, first of all, I think in answer to your first part of the question, I think it's pure weakness of character that I haven't changed. I just don't think I'm made that way. I don't think I'm not organized in anything that I do. I am someone who you can rely on. I don't like being late particularly. So when I say deadlines, that doesn't mean that I fly over deadlines. I don't like missing deadlines, and I don't like being late for people. So I'm not someone who is chaotic in that sense, but I am, you know, gosh, you know, having said I'm never late, I am always running to everything. I am always arriving at events or at people's houses for parties or dinner with wet hair because I haven't had time to dry it. You know, it's just that I think I'm just wired that way. Apart from when it comes to traveling, trains and planes, I don't like rushing for trains and planes. So I will always turn up a little bit earlier and get myself a coffee. But I think, I hope one day the future holds a lovely, organized, peaceful writer, Amanda, and I can wake up and brew myself a lovely coffee and wander to my study and sit down and write 1500 words and then go, and I don't know, it's just that even saying that, it sort of feels like it's an unattainable goal that will just never happen to me. But
lastly, on the day, on the days when it is hard and the words aren't coming out, have you learned anything along the way, any small little tips or tricks for you? Something maybe an idiosyncrasy that is just so niche it's not worth reporting, but I promise you it is. Like anything that's tiny that just helps you get them down that day.
I mean, you know, this is where I don't feel proud of the way I write, because I do suffer from that horrendously badly. So I try and be cross with myself, and I try and tell myself that everybody else has jobs and they don't have the privilege of sort of, you know, waking up one day and just feeling like they don't want to be, you know, a nurse, or don't want to be, you know, going to London like my husband has to do and commuting. So I do try and be a little bit tough on myself and just say, look, you're not allowed to indulge this. But on the other hand, realistically, I can spend hours staring at the screen and flipping between Twitter or rightmove.co.uk or whatever it is that's sort of grabbed my attention. So I think in terms of things, I'm someone who is easily bored, I think, and I'm often... I get addicted to the latest fad and it will work for me and I'll think my whole life has changed, and then, you know, 2 weeks later I found I've drifted back into bad habits. But things that have happened to me in fads have been writer races with friends. So just sort of, you know, being having a friend and we say, right, we're going to write from now until, I don't know, 10 o'clock, and then we'll check in and see how many words we've done. That has worked for a time. I'm actually, after you and I have spoken today, I've got two friends who are on deadline to the end of July, middle of August, and we are about to start doing exactly that, having a sort of verbal contract of what we pledge to each other. And I'm hoping that will be enough to kick me in. But generally, I have to be very firm with myself. I have to turn off the internet. I have to shut the door, and I have to say, just write. You are not allowed to not write today. Just write. And my husband will be also, he's quite complicit in trying to get me to write. So he'll suddenly say, you know, I'd really like to read a chapter tonight. Can you get it down? So that helps.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional.
Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Now, we'll have more from Amanda in just a sec. Just a little bit of business to clear up before we do. I've just come back from a holiday. It went very well. Thank you very much. So that means if you are waiting on Patreon goodies, just bear with me while I get them all sorted. If you want to be on that list for merch, you need to help us out over at patreon.com/writersroutine. You can get small bits of merch on there, token of thanks for our support, that kind of stuff. You can even get your new book to sponsor this show. So if you love what we do, if you've learned anything along the way that has helped the way that you tell your stories, if you're enjoying the fact we've tried to get inspiration to you every week through lockdown, then please do say thanks to us with a dollar or so every month. It really helps the show out, I promise. A little goes an incredibly long way. You can do that. Support us over at patreon.com/writersroutine. Right, let's get back to it with part two of this week's episode. We're talking to Amanda Jennings about her new novel, The Storm. Now, in this half, we talk about how she plots and how much she knows, or rather doesn't know, about the plot. You can also hear about all the drafts that she does, and there are a lot of them, or up to like 13 or something ridiculous. And we talk about how it changes between between draft one and maybe draft two, and how she even wants to change things now. And we pick things up talking about lockdown. You see, we recorded this a few months ago, like right in the middle of being stuck at home, of every day being the same, of not knowing when it was all going to change. How did she feel in that time? How was it being creative when there was nothing there to inspire you?
I don't want to admit it, because it feels there's so much serious stuff going on, and there are so many people who are having a horrendous time, a sad time, a difficult time, a worrying time. So it feels rather flippant to sort of say, and, you know, put my hand against my forehead and say, and I'm struggling creatively to do this. But actually I am, and I'm not alone. I know there are other people in creative industries who are struggling. It's difficult when the world outside is so new and unusual, and it sort of trumps whatever imagination you've got in your head. What's going on outside is even more mad and weird and wonderful and fascinating and unusual. So it's very difficult to disengage from that, because I actually found this not just with the pandemic, but with the politics that was raging since 2016. It was just sort of every single day, but actually you turned on the radio or opened up social media, and on the hour it was changing. It was the sands were shifting so rapidly that it was fascinating to watch, and I found it very difficult to disengage. And actually, I wrote The Storm through that, so I really had to battle to sit myself down and disengage. And I have had to periodically go on social media breaks where I totally turn down, you know, take away all my accounts, so I can't even get on. But the pandemic, this recent lockdown has been different for me, because I have the family around me. I'm fortunate that I have older children. So I had my daughter, who's just finished university. She was in lockdown with us with her boyfriend, and my 18-year-old and our 14-year-old. So we had a busy house. And that was quite distracting, just not having that. You know, I was describing it to them, saying that when they leave at 8 o'clock in the morning, there's all this bustle and getting ready for school, and it's all like, where's this? And you're going to be late. And then suddenly the door shuts and it's very, very peaceful. And although I learned to write, as we spoke about earlier, I learned to write in the chaos of motherhood and the chaos of a house, obviously, for the last, how old is Lexi now? So for the last 9 years, I've been writing in the peace and quiet. So it is distracting having that all around as well. And like I said, I've sort of set up the mutual aid group for the village, and did a lot of that because there were so many people that were there shielding, were not able to shop or pick up prescriptions, and there was a hole there that needed filling as well. So it's been a difficult time, but I'm just, you know, as you said, 100 days in, I've slightly got to the stage now where I'm like, you know, we need to you need to crack on and just disengage and get this written, or at least compartmentalize what is going on outside with what you have to do. Because, you know, I'm contracted. It's a job now. I do have to deliver something.
Well, you mentioned that for the last few years, you were head down in the storm in amongst everything that's going on. Can you tell me, Amanda, about the very first moment that the idea for what became this story came into your head? What was that? What was the light bulb? What was the elevator pitch? How did it present itself to you? The very first idea.
Okay, I mean, it's interesting because actually the very first idea, I suppose, is quite different to sort of the idea that developed. As I told you before, you know, there's a lot of notebook time with working out where I want to go with something. But I was down in Cornwall where my previous book, The Cliff House, is set, and I was doing a little bit of publicity for that, had been going to bookshops and tours, and I decided to get up early one morning before sunrise, and I took a drive around where my mother's side of the family's from, so sort of Penzance area, and went down to the fishing port of Newlyn, and had a walk around the streets of Newlyn. Sort of, it was winter time, probably October, November time, so it was quite winter. It was quite wet, and it was very atmospheric and very deserted. But obviously, there was still, you know, people were sort of busying around in the fishing with the fishing industry, and I suddenly realized that I would quite like to write something about that was set in the fishing industry, that was set around one night where everything went wrong. So I'd started to read around the fishing industry, and it's one of the most dangerous jobs. A trawler fisherman is one of the most dangerous jobs in the world. The more research I started doing, the more I thought this is actually something I really love to write about, a really sort of traumatic event at sea that then has spiraling effects as the men come off the trawler and they're dealing with what happened at sea and how that feeds into them having one night in the community and getting drunk and in the pub and things spiraling from there and going wrong. And I wanted to, the way I look at my books tend to have something that's happened in the past that then affects people in the future. So I then came up with the story of my heroine, if you like, Hannah, who is married to a man that really, really cannot quite understand why she's married to him. And I had the dual idea of wanting to write about, well, sometimes when you see men and women in relationships that are affected by domestic abuse, not violent domestic abuse in this case, but coercive control, you often hear people saying, well, I don't understand why she or he didn't leave. And I wanted to pose that question and have a specific reason that was set in their history of why she didn't leave.
There's a lot going on. You're covering quite a few different topics and themes there. You said something towards the end that was quite fascinating. It was all gold, but you know what I mean? Like, that really did just set the fire going. You said, my books tend to be... have things in the past that affect things in the present. How much does that come into play when you are creating new ideas? When you have an initial idea, it's quite hard for me to kind of articulate this. When you have an idea, how much are you thinking, right, I need it to be something in the past that affects what's happening in the future? And why do you keep coming back to that motif?
I'm really fascinated by the long reaching effects of a certain event. So rather than being interested in the whodunit, if you like, all the ones written so far have all been tied up with the why done it. And that's what fascinates me. For my second book, for example, I think this sort of articulates it in a way that brings it back into my experience. So my husband was at, he won a choral scholarship to a boarding prep school. He was at the local school, and his mum and dad thought that this would be a sort of opportunity that he shouldn't turn down. So he went to this boarding prep school when he was really quite young, to be a choral, you know, a chorister. And he always told me, that that was a dark time in his life, and that there were boys there that were not having a great time of it. And he never spoke of it with fondness. In fact, he didn't speak about it at all. And a few years into probably about 10 years into our relationship, maybe a little bit longer even, but we were settled and had all of our children, I think, or at least two of them. And he got a phone call from a police officer while he was at work. And she said, you know, could I speak to Christopher Jennings? And he immediately said, is this to do with my school? Which was 20 odd years before. And she said, it is, you know, how did you know? And he said, I've been waiting for this phone call for 20 years. And he came home, and it was like, it was literally that lid of Pandora's box, you know, as if someone had pulled a scab off, and everything that he had sort of just dismissed with me as sort of just a dark time in his life came sort of pouring out. And I found him at the computer in the middle of the night. He was researching all the kids that he'd been at school with, working out who had been, there was a couple of teachers who were being historically investigated, who had been victims of these teachers and what had happened to them. And he would just sort of kept coming and saying, oh, you know, I've just found another one has had a terrible life, or this person or that. It fascinated me from a writer's point of view. Obviously it distressed me as his wife, but it was that you could bury so much emotion and have a completely normal life. He'd never sort of, you know, you wouldn't know that he had had this sort of difficult time. He wasn't hurt himself. It was just what he witnessed around him, or the atmosphere around him. And so I just felt, you know, I wrote a book about sort of based on those feelings, on someone who had buried something for 20 years and someone returned to their life and it opened it all up again. And therefore it's sort of like putting a hand grenade into your life. And I think it's that hand grenade moment that I am fascinated by.
I'm curious about how you get there each time. So we're taking things back to the storm. When you've got that initial idea, you want there to be something that happens out at sea, in the fishing industry, which is affecting what's happening today. This is quite like a loose, open question, so kind of run with it as you want. But what happens next for you as a writer? You're not that much of a planner, but you've got your notebooks, and you did say that what the storm became was quite different to the initial idea. What work are you doing on it to move it from that idea to you actually sitting down and typing it on the screen?
Yeah, and actually hearing you say that back, I do question this now, six books in. I do wonder whether I am more of a planner than I think I am. It's just that it doesn't happen in a sort of formal way. So I do have, as we've discussed, these notebooks, and it is literally like I mind map everything. So I'll sort of say, that there's a characteristic of my heroine's character, and then I want to have a scene, for example, that would demonstrate that, but we'll set that back in the past. And then actually that scene I've just written that demonstrates the characteristic I want to show in the present, well, that opens up a whole different sort of relationship with that character. And so things like, I sort of see it as a spider web. It's sort of, you know, it reaches out like an ink blot on a drop of ink on some blotting paper. It sort of ekes out and grows bigger and more complex, and the web grows tighter and stronger. And often when I'm writing, a scene will come about because I've sort of, maybe I've written something that makes one of the characters seem very unsympathetic, and I'll think, probably quite manipulatively, but then we are writers and that's what we do for a living. But I will then sort of think, well, I need to get my readers back on board. I need them. I don't want them to lose sympathy with Hannah now. I need them back on board. So I might write a scene in the backstory, for example, that then warms her up and shows a different side of her character, which hopefully allows the reader to feel sympathy with her again. So for me, it's just an organic sort of increasing and magnifying and turning down, and within each rewrite as well, I'll go through it and I'll think, do you know what, that character's now, that's now irrelevant. We don't need her or him. So I'll get rid of her. But then likewise, I'll read something and it'll feel like a sort of little thread of gold in the grey. And I'll think, actually, we'll turn the heat up on that one. We'll bring that to the fore. So it's all about really I think I equate it often to having to a sculptor having a lump of clay and then gradually just shaping it and refining it and making something recognizable come out of this sort of ingredients that you have before you, if you like. Well, I don't know the ending at all, so I don't know where I'm going. And that doesn't scare me at all, because actually I know now that the ending will come once I really know the characters. So like you said, I've got this shadowy set of characters that I know vaguely, their names, their age, are they good looking, are they not, are they confident, are they shy, are they so I have a vague idea. But then as the books are rewritten, I'll start to sort of, you know, you could ask me, for example, a question about one of my characters in The Storm, and I'll tell you, you know, what's their favourite cereal. I won't even have to think. I will know now exactly what Hannah's favourite cereal is, or because I know the characters so well. So I think when I start off, I have a vague direction. I sort of, you know, if I know what I'm going to do that day, if we're going to use the car analogy, I know we're going on a picnic and I know we're going to head north, but I don't know the details. So I think, and also from that collection of notebooks, I will also have probably, I don't know, maybe I wouldn't want to put a number on it, but let's say between 8 and 20 key scenes that are very visual and are very locked in my head, which will sort of form stepping stones for me to move from one section of the journey to the next. I would think if we were going to use your roadmap analogy, we would say that sort of someone has sort of just given me some vague directions and I'm sort of following them, and I think I can remember where we're going, but if we take a wrong turn, it doesn't matter, we'll get there in the end. So I think that's probably a little bit more how I write.
And in a much more narrowed down day-to-day style of that, knowing what you're going to write, you did say earlier as well, you mentioned a planned scene. So if you know that you want to sit there and try and get as much of a chapter as you can down, how do you know what you're writing each day?
That is a very good question. I think that is probably at first draft stage instinctive. So I think I will, for example, it's not The Storm, but if I take the book I'm writing at the moment, I've got three characters. I'm being quite rigid about the fact that they are alternating. So I'm one character followed by the next, and then that repeats with the same, you know, one after the other. So, and I will wake, I know, for example, my characters are one of them has just decided to buy a farm to set up a commune. When that character comes back for her turn, I know that she's now going to describe the day they arrive on the farm. Do not tell me how I've decided that. I have no idea. I suppose that's just where the instinctive bit comes in. I suppose it's because there's nothing of note particularly that happens between them deciding they're going to do this thing and then 3 months later they are embarking. And if we had to go through the whole 3 months, it would be incredibly dull for everybody concerned, not least myself. So I think it's probably instinctive, the bits of the story that I feel are the ones that advance the narrative but also going to be interesting. That's not to say that those chapters might be cut at a later date if I'm reading through and I think they're dragging or they're slow or they're not doing what I want to do, they don't tell anything more about the characters or the story, then I will be very happy to cut them. I don't have any sort of set idea about that. Each stage is approached very separate to the last stage. So my first draft, I just want to get the words down and tell the story and get something to work with, my lump of clay. And then in each rewrite, and it can be anything up to 10 or 11 rewrites, 12 sometimes, it will change again. Those veins of gold that I've seen will come to the fore. Everything else will be knocked back. Some boring bits will be cut. And occasionally I'll get to the sort of eighth rewrite and I'll suddenly think, you know what we need? We need a different character's voice here. And a new character will arrive, or one of the characters that's had a sort of bit part might suddenly find their voice. So it's all quite organic, really.
When you're doing so many rewrites, how are they changing? So perhaps not when a new character suddenly springs to the fore, but what's going on between rewrite 10 and rewrite 11?
A lot of tinkering. My agent has to actually take the book away from me before I start saying, oh, do you know what, that whole chapter's really boring, let's ditch it. And she's like, no, it's not boring if you haven't read it 400 times. It's absolutely, let's keep that in. So I just tinkering. I'll take when I'm rewriting, even if you gave me one of the books that I've already written and published now, I would want to shape every sentence again. It's a compulsion, and I will sit there, and for me as well, I think sentences and paragraphs have to have a rhythm. So I like to think that if you've structured the sentence in the right way, then you're helping the reader.
Can you pick apart that rhythm? Sorry, very quickly, just because a few writers have mentioned the rhythm, and it just seems this. It's not tangible, you know. Who knows what a rhythm is? What just because a rhythm is good for you, it might be completely different for someone else. What in your mind, what is the perfect beat and rhythm of one of your sentences?
Well, I mean, again, I think you sort of probably hit on it. Just, you know, within that question, is it's actually very. There isn't a set. Rhythm, I think that's what gives a book and a writer their voice. It's each if a writer is writing a book, and they keep to their rhythm, and their rhythm is the same, you know, that their rhythm is instinctive, then that is what people talk about when they say a writer's voice, I suppose. For me, I just like it to feel balanced. I like a set. So if I'm reading it aloud or I'm reading it in my head, it's almost, there is no set rhythm, but it's almost got to have a beat. It's got to sort of have a beat underneath it so that it doesn't jar for me. I think if it jars that you lose your rhythm, you lose your sort of concentration. You want a reader to be immersed in the words, I suppose. So I think, you know, there's nothing prescriptive about it. I wouldn't be able to analyze it to that extent, I don't think, certainly not in a sort of academic way, but it's just, again, I've mentioned the word before, but instinct, I think, what feels right and what sounds right. And I think for me, it's not just the sentences, it's the shape on the page, the paragraphs. You don't want to have long sentence after long sentence after long sentence. You want to, for me, I like to punctuate that with shorter sentences, sometimes one word, sometimes a new line. I suppose a little bit like the sort of the things that I might have learned from poetry or reading poetry, I suppose, is possible. I don't, like I said, I haven't really thought about it from an academic point of view, but I certainly know that I like to have the rhythm has to sit well with me.
You seem to me to be a writer that holds at the front of their mind, more than others I've chatted to, the idea of themes. You talked about themes earlier on. How conscious and how, for want of a better word, forced. I don't mean forced in a negative way, but you know what I mean. When you're writing this story, how much at the front of your brain are the themes of your piece? How do you decide what they are, and how do you navigate them and put them through your story?
Yeah, well, they're not forced in the terms of the fact that, obviously, you know, as I've said a few times, nothing is planned, so it starts off and off I go. So I don't sort of have in my notebooks, it doesn't say this is a book about guilt or this is a book about prison or isolation or whatever it is. I just know that I just like, there's a sort of, I think it's that sort of foreshadowing and echoing. People talk about foreshadowing, if you like. I suppose that's what I mean about theme. It's that sort of idea that if you're writing a book about isolation, for example, it's a neat little, neat little device just to have a few other sort of moments of isolation or loneliness so that people can draw parallels. I would never do that. I hope I would never do that so that it feels like a brick in the face. And I wouldn't necessarily put in the blurb or even when I'm selling a book, well, this is a book about isolation and you have to know that to enjoy it. That's not that at all. It's more just, it feels, you know, neat to me, I suppose. Like, so the one I'm writing now, The Bodmin Moor, I've got on the wall, that happens to be about isolation is a theme in that one because of one of my characters. But actually, I've also set it on Bodmin Moor. Now, I didn't set it on Bodmin Moor because it was a book about isolation. I just think that's happened instinctively. It's a sort of, you know, where would a person who is isolating themselves from the world want to live? Well, not in the centre of London, or well, maybe central London. That's a different type of isolation. But, you know, they wouldn't set themselves in a very warm, small community and go down and involve themselves in that community. Therefore, they would be more likely to go and seek out solitary space on Bodmin Moor. That, I suppose, that's how it works for me. It's not an exact science, I have to say. It's just something I enjoy doing, and I enjoy having I enjoy a book that has a sort of overarching theme in terms of emotions and the areas of the sort of human condition, I suppose, for want of a better word, that I'm exploring.
And that is it for this week's Writer's Routine. Thank you so much to Amanda Jennings for coming on the show. If you like what you've heard, if you want to grab a copy of The Storm, please do it using the link in the podcast notes, wherever you're listening, and over at writersroutine.com. Then we'll just get a little kickback, tiny but very important amount from the books that you buy. While you're at writersroutine.com, by the way, you can get in contact with us there. Use the contact form, obviously, and just let us know what you think. That'd be really handy. And you can leave us a review over on Apple Podcasts and say hello there as well. That would really help people who need the help of our authors find the help of our authors, and make sure you're subscribed as well. That way, next week's episode with Mena Van Praagh will automatically appear in your podcast feed. She'll be on to chat to us about her new novel. It's a fantasy. It's called The Sisters Grimm, and it's a brilliant take on all those old-fashioned fairy tales. That's next week. Also, give us a follow on Twitter if you can. We are at WritersPod there. And support the show on Patreon, patreon.com/writersroutine. A little will really go a long way there. And I will see you next week with Mena Van Praagh on the show. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.